Welcome. You are listening to Park Avenue Podcasts, and this is Rabbi Elliot Cosgrove. While it's always better to hear it live, this is a place to be to catch the music, sermons, and select programs of Park Avenue Synagogue. If you like what you are hearing or want to learn more about the community, please check out our website at www.pasyn.org. Enjoy our latest installment.
Shabbat Shalom. 50 years ago today, at actually this precise moment, Rabbi Art Green began a 1970 Dvar Torah based on the opening verses of this week's Parsha, Parshat Truma. Speak unto the children of Israel, have them take gifts for me from every person whose heart so moves him. Build for me a sanctuary that I may dwell among them. A recent graduate of the Jewish Theological Seminary, Rabbi Green, together with about 20 other students and teachers, had created Chaburat Shalom, a Jewish communal fellowship in Cambridge, Massachusetts. The Chaburah, as described by one of its founding members, Dr. David Roskies, was a combination of ashram, monastery, shtiebel, seminary, and urban kibbutz, reflecting the counterculture of the late 1960s. While there was undoubtedly a practical element to the seminary, a way for draft resistors to gain military deferments as ministry students, the driving ethos of the scrappy community were profound spiritual principles, both revolutionary and restorative. They were revolutionary in that these Jews rejected the establishment materialism of a 1950s goodbye Columbus American Jewish life, rejected the frontal and formalized cantorial style of prayer of American Jewish synagogues, rejected the dry scholasticism of rabbinic education, rejected a host of social and political conventions as received from prior generations. But they were also restorative in that, unlike other radicals of the time who rejected religion altogether or turned to other faiths, the members of Chaburat Shalom leaned into their Judaism. They sought to retrieve the authentic spirit, sound, and teachings of Judaism. They turned to contemplative prayer, to traditional Jewish study, and to a model of communal membership based on mutual covenant and dialogue, not a membership form one sends into a synagogue office. Be it prayer services that began by way of wordless nigunim, anti-war marches in D.C., or concluding a service by singing Adon Olam to Scarborough Fair, Chaburat Shalom represented a spiritual, scriptural, and communal retrieval of Judaism, its participants' unique spiritual gifts leveraged towards building a holy community, all of which was the gist of what Rabbi Green spoke about that morning, how the private spiritual offerings of the individual could collectively serve to renew Judaism, building a home fit for God's presence. The story of Chaburat Shalom and similar countercultural communities in New York, D.C., Boston, or the Bay Area at the time can be found in various histories of American Jewry, along with the nostalgia or hallucinogenic-tinged reminiscence of their founding members. This morning, I want to focus not so much on the community itself, but on its reception, impact, and afterlife in American Jewry. Because at the time, it was seen as a threat to the establishment. This week, I spoke to one of its founders who shared with me that the local Boston rabbi confronted them that they should join a regular synagogue, and they objected on the grounds that his pews were screwed literally and figuratively into the ground. And truth be told, the heyday of Chaburat Shalom didn't last very long, its utopian phase just about 5 years. After the war, its founding membership went on to build family and careers. And yet, despite its countercultural leanings, despite its short-lived nature, it wouldn't be an understatement to say that the last 50 years of American Jewry has been shaped directly and indirectly by the spirit and personalities of Chaburat Shalom. Its impact can be measured in many ways. The scores of present-day independent communities for whom Chaburat Shalom is their progenitor, Its founding personalities, Art Green, Jim Kugel, Michael Fishbane, Michael Brooks, amongst others who constitute a generation of American Jewish spiritual, scholarly, academic, and institutional leadership. The do-it-yourself Jewish catalog publications of its members that adorn countless Jewish bookshelves today. And perhaps the most deeply felt impact are the ones that we live and breathe but can't be cataloged and codified. The fact of egalitarian prayer and clergy, American Jewry's present-day commitment to Tikkun Olam, the countless study circles, Jewish yoga, Maya, Melton, and Limud classes that pepper Jewish communities, our own included. The fact that one cannot enter a prayer service without hearing a neo-Hasidic melody, or in our case, a hallelujah sung to Leonard Cohen. The list goes on, but the point is one and the same. Chavurat Shalom is important to study because it's a great case study for how disruptive innovation happens, in this case, in the American Jewish community. How a new reactionary model emerged, responsive to new circumstances, conditions, and sentiments, which, though initially overlooked or even rejected by the establishment, was eventually transformed from being an ignored outcast to integrated into the DNA of the very establishment against which it rebelled. You know, given the membership of the congregation I serve, it's with great humility that I speak about anything having to do with business management or theory. But ever since the sad and untimely passing of Harvard business professor Clayton Christensen, I found myself totally intrigued by his theory of disruptive innovation, made famous by his celebrated book, The Innovator's Dilemma. As best as I can tell, Christensen describes what happens when an industry leader focused on institutional stewardship and good management is unable to identify the new trends, circumstances, and opportunities on the horizon. As best as I can understand the theory, a disruptive company emerges with an alternative targeting a segment of the market overlooked or underserved by incumbent competitors. Initially, that alternative may be of inferior quality and only serving a narrow part of the market. Eventually, however, the disruptors get their act together and present a challenge to the industry leaders. Examples abound. RCA, who wouldn't stop using vacuum tubes and was outfoxed by Sony and its transistors. Sears, once regarded as the best-managed retailer of the world, who failed to see the challenges of Walmart's lower pricing or online shopping. Digital equipment that was blind to the arrival of desktop computers. Kodak lost its near-monopoly position in the film business with the emergence of digital photography. And most famously, Blockbuster Video blindsided by Netflix, Hulu, and otherwise. Not every story leads to bankruptcy. There are some examples, like the airline business, who adapted to the challenge of JetBlue and Southwest, or Garmin, who refined their mission with the advent of Google Maps. The best example is probably Apple, arguably the best second act in corporate history. Having introduced the first personal computers in 76, it was overrun nearly completely by Microsoft's operating system, but then went on to totally reinvent itself by way of iPods, iTunes, iPhones, iPads, and the rest, as they say, is history. These success stories are the stories of companies who are able to be eyes wide open to the emergent landscape, learn from the disruptors, integrate their wisdom into their model, and boldly reconstruct their mission to meet or define the future. Christensen, God-fearing Mormon he was, knew his Bible, and so I imagine he would have appreciated the example of disruptive innovation of this week's Torah reading. The children of Israel, having just received the Torah at Mount Sinai, had to transform their communal structure, national identity, and religious life, from being situated at the base of the mountain to the wilderness wandering ahead. Remaining at the mountain wasn't an option. The promised land beckoned. Leaving the site of revelation risked taking leave of the divine presence. It was a 13th century Spanish commentator, Nachmanides, who noted that it's exactly this dilemma that prompted the Mishkan about which our B'nai Mitzvah spoke about, the desert tabernacle to accompany the Israelites into the years ahead. The centralized model of Mount Sinai had served its purpose. God's Shekhinah presence would no longer abide at the mountaintop. The Mishkan became the portable transistor, if you will, where God's presence would be experienced by Moses and all of Israel. The pattern is there, a challenge to the received model, an innovation introduced, the religion of Israelite revolutionized and sustained from one chapter to the next. It's not a complete triumph. There will be doubters. The sin of the golden calf is just around the corner. But for the moment, it's a model of reconstruction that would make any MBA proud. And it's this spirit of reconstructing the model of our faith that's been the hallmark of our people's strength from generation to generation. The Mishkan wouldn't last forever. When Israel arrived in the Promised Land, they turned to a centralized model of the Jerusalem temple to experience God's presence. And then when the temple was destroyed at the hands of the Romans, the innovations of the Pharisees were adapted as Judaism was transformed from a temple-based religion to a rabbinic faith. The Shabbat table, for example, is known as a Mikdash Me'at, a temple in miniature, where God's presence can be experienced week to week in our homes. Sometimes a transformation is willing. Sometimes it's a response to catastrophe. Sometimes the establishment embraces the disruptive innovator, and sometimes it resists. The story of Chavurat Shalom 50 years ago is instructive because it represents an example of disruptive innovation that in retrospect served to bolster the establishment. Yet another case study when our people, faced with new conditions, undertook to re-express our inheritance, combining the old and the new, so much so that today we can't imagine it otherwise. And in case you're wondering, it's this sentiment that's informing the present efforts of our synagogue. As you may know, with the dedication of our new campus complete, we're embarking on a strategic plan to set the course for our future. We're asking questions about worship, about programming, about social justice, our congregational school, travel, education, inclusion, about just about everything. But more important than any sphere of synagogue life is the spirit guiding our efforts. What are we not doing that we need to do? What are others doing that we could do better? What are the trends on the horizon that we have to be alert and responsive to? Who are the disruptors in our midst, and how can we integrate their wisdom into our present efforts? If 70% of Jews will marry someone not born of the Jewish faith, how shall we position the synagogue for that reality? In a world and a week where support for Israel has been politicized to toxic heights, how can the synagogue function to help bridge the divide? As we affirm our strength and breathe in the beauty of this building, what are the seen and unseen barriers to entry preventing people from entering a rich Jewish life? It's not about a change of mission. As long as I'm rabbi of the synagogue, we'll remain true to being a house of prayer, of study, and of community, a place to inspire, educate, and support our membership towards living passion-filled Jewish lives. But in order to stay vital, how we accomplish that mission means that we are self-reflective, we learn from others, and we're willing to be called out on our blind spots. We're not Blockbuster, nor for that matter are we Apple. We are industry leaders with a self-imposed insistence to constantly reimagine what we do. As the late Andy Grove remarked, success breeds complacency. Complacency breeds failure. Only the paranoid survive. There are those in this world who would have you believe that the game is won by sticking to fundamentals, and others who chase innovation and trick plays. We reject that choice as a false one. In the words of my favorite industry leader, the late great Bo Schembechler, in this big house, we emphasize both execution and innovation. We're loyal to our principles, and we're ready to scrap the script if a new one needs to be written. Build for me a sanctuary that I may dwell among them. 50 years ago, 500 years ago, thousands of years ago, the calling card of our people has been how to build a communal vision fit to house God's presence. We know our mission. It's as compelling as when first stated. How we do it, the materials we use, the people we learn from, our eyes, hearts, and minds must always remain open. Each one of us has a gift of ourselves to give towards that project. And I invite you to be part of that process to build our collective and very bright future. Shabbat Shalom.
Thank you for listening to Park Avenue Podcasts, a place to be to catch the music, sermons, and select programs of Park Avenue Synagogue. If you like what you are hearing or want to learn more about the community, please check out our website at www.pasyn.org. See you in shul. Hallelujah.